Depot's Tribune Radio is on the air. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. On this month's program, we look at the American Revolution and what it means to us today with historian, activist, and writer Chris Mahan.
People who are oppressed have the right to make revolution. I mean, the Declaration of Independence explicitly states that if you are oppressed, not only do you have a right to make a revolution, but that you have a duty to make that revolution. I'll read you the passage right here. It says that prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly, all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security.
That, plus our featured monthly commentary on People's Tribune Radio. But first, these news stories from Nicole Trejo.
This from AInfos. A coalition of organizations have been developing a booklet describing what the World Trade Organization is, its track record, and what we can expect to see in the upcoming ministerial meeting in Seattle, scheduled for November 29th through December 3rd. Included in the booklet, The WTO and Corporate Globalization, What is the WTO and How It Works, The Record of the WTO, A Threat to Democracy, Health, and the Environment, and a list of resources and contacts. For more information, contact Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. And from the Earth Day 2000 campaign. In 1990, over 200 million people in 141 countries celebrated Earth Day. On Earth Day 2000, half a billion people around the world will demonstrate for the environment. Events already planned include a concert in the Philippines, events all over China, a march in South Africa, a protest in France, and more. Already, 1,500 groups in 146 countries have joined the Earth Day 2000 worldwide campaign. Check out the organizers at www.earthday.net.
People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, who also publish the newspaper People's Tribune, Tribuno del Pueblo. Stay tuned for contact and ordering information at the end of the program. And now, author, historian, and activist Chris Mahan on the American Revolution. Chris Mahan was interviewed by Sandy Reed.
If you want to understand today, you have to look at the past. If you want to understand a phenomenon, you have to look at how it began. And this country began through the American Revolution. And there are certain problems that were not resolved in the American Revolution that are still with us, and there were certain principles that were asserted in the American Revolution that most people still believe in, and yet the reality of the society contradicts those principles. And so where this society is going to go, if you're going to understand where the society is going to go, you have to understand something about where it began, and it began at the time of the American Revolution. Clearly, the American Revolution is an incredibly contradictory thing. I mean, here you have a revolution against monarchy, a revolution against colonialism. Monarchy was one of the most horrible institutions in the history of the world. To have it challenged morally in the American Revolution was an extraordinarily good thing. Direct colonialism is one of the world's horrors. I mean, the British Empire, the French Empire, all the whole system of world imperialism and colonialism was just a monstrous thing. I mean, it's pretty much been destroyed now, but the old form of colonialism. To have it challenged was an extraordinarily good thing. At the same time, you have this incredible contradiction where you have the Declaration of Independence being written by a man who owned 150 other human beings as slaves. Originally, when the British colonies were established in North America, the first permanent one was established at Jamestown, Virginia in 1607. Originally, these colonists love the British Empire. I mean, they were agents of the British Empire. They were they were sort of like the people on the Israeli settlers on the West Bank. I mean, they were very hardcore defenders of the British Empire. They were there to spread the British flag. And so at first, everything was good between, relations were good between the British settlers and the British government. But what happens is that as these British settlers, as their population began to increase, as their commerce began to increase, their wealth began to increase, they began to want to spread westward across the Appalachian Mountains into new territory. The British government in London wanted to control them because it wanted this situation, this economic situation called mercantilism, where the colony exists simply to supply raw materials to the mother country and to accept exports from the mother country, and there's a relationship of economic domination. So that's what leads to the development of the tension between the British colonists in North America and the British government in London. But at the same time, there was also debate, and there were many ideas that were put forward in the course of the revolution, which were good ideas, which were ideas challenging monarchy, challenging colonialism, and which are part of the legacy of progressive political thought of the world. As these 13 different colonies began to increase in population, as they became more wealthy, they wanted freedom of movement, literally in the sense of being the freedom to move westward. They wanted to be able to pass their own laws. They wanted to be able to trade with one another. So they began to challenge the right of the British government in London to make all the decisions. When the British government tried to curtail their activity, when it issued a proclamation line saying that they could not go west of the Appalachian Mountains, when it passed from London, from the Parliament in London, the Stamp Act, the tea tax, all these different acts, and never consulted the people in their local provisional legislatures or houses of assembly in these 13 colonies, the people in the 13 colonies, particularly the political leaders, began to advocate this idea of no taxation without representation. In other words, we weren't consulted, therefore we don't have to obey this stuff. Ultimately, that does lead to a situation where some of the more radical political leaders are saying that the American colonies have the right to be free and independent of the British Crown itself, and some of them challenge the legitimacy of the institution of monarchy itself, and say that in particular Thomas Paine, who for his time was very radical, advocates in his pamphlet Common Sense the idea that the whole notion of kings is bogus. It's just a ridiculous idea that the first king in the history of the world was just a bully who managed to force other people to bow down to him, and it's a morally bankrupt concept. See, at first, many of the people in the 13 colonies simply thought that the king's ministers, you know, you had a situation even then where the prime minister and the cabinet makes a lot of the decisions in the British government. Many of the people in the 13 colonies believed that the ministers, the prime minister and his cabinet, were making these bad decisions for King George III, but that King George III was essentially a nice guy, and the key thing is a legitimate ruler in the country, and that kingship and monarchy was a legitimate institution. They saw themselves as being British. They saw themselves as people who had certain rights because they were British, and the ministers in London were violating these rights, but many of them did not want to stop being British. They did not want to stop a situation where there was a king in England. And someone had to convince them, someone had to introduce the new idea that, you know, kingship is a bogus idea, monarchy is a bankrupt institution, and these 13 colonies are a separate nation and should go their own separate way. And that role is played by pamphleteers like Thomas Paine and other people. In 1763, the French and Indian War ends. And that means that Canada is no longer controlled by France, it's controlled by England. So England then moves to take control of all of its colonies in North America, and it begins to clamp down. And as a result of that, you have these protests, which to take, well, first of all, you have all sorts of acts which are passed by the British government, you know, the Stamp Act and the Tea Acts and the Navigation Acts and all these different acts, and they essentially constrain the people of the 13 colonies, tell them that they have to trade through Britain, put various taxes on their commerce and so forth, and protest begins against that. You have a Stamp Act Congress in 1765. You have the development of the Sons of Liberty and the Daughters of Liberty. You have rioting. You have people looting colonial governors' mansions, all sorts of things like that. But this starts in 1765, and it continues. The Declaration of Independence doesn't take place until 1776, so that's 11 years. And even as late as 1775, or even the very beginning of 1776, a lot of people are not yet convinced that we have to break the British connection. As I mentioned earlier, there are two sides to the American Revolution. One side of it is you can be cynical, or you can take the most negative interpretation of the American Revolution and say it was just a group of people who wanted to break the bounds that connected them to the British government so that they could expand westward and commit genocide against the Indians so that they could make themselves more money. That may be true of some of the people who participated in the revolution, but it only deals with one side of the revolution. The other side of it is that there was a genuine revolutionary tumult that took place. There was turmoil. There were all different forces that were involved in the revolution from below, and that out of the revolution, particularly from some of the poorer sections of society, there were ideas that were put forward that really have helped change the world. I mean, one of them was the idea that monarchy is just an absolutely bankrupt and illegitimate institution. The other is the idea that colonialism is an illegitimate institution. And particularly on the positive side, there's the idea that people who are oppressed have the right to make revolution. I mean, the Declaration of Independence explicitly states that if you are oppressed, not only do you have a right to make a revolution, but that you have a duty to make that revolution. And in fact, I'll read you the passage right here. It says that prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly, all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. So it says right there, their duty to make a revolution if, in fact, there's a situation where society is headed towards absolute despotism. So I think that the question for us today is, don't we live in a society that's headed towards absolute despotism? It certainly seems to me to be headed in that direction. I mean, you look at the police brutality, you look at the mandatory minimum sentencing laws, you look at the rise of the death penalty, you look at the censorship, you look at everything that's taking place in this society today. Seems to me we're headed towards absolute despotism, and the Declaration of Independence says that in a situation like that, you have not only a right, but a duty to make a revolution. The question for us is, you know, in the American Revolution of the 1770s, people felt that was a time of tremendous new possibilities. I think it's summarized best by a really beautiful passage in Common Sense by Thomas Paine, where he talks about that America has the power, as he put it, to begin the world over again. And he said that a situation similar to the present hath not happened since the days of Noah until now. The birthday of a new world is at hand. And he saw a world without monarchy, and that would change the world. We do have a time similar to the time of Noah. I mean, the flood under Noah just destroyed the old society and allowed humanity to rebuild. If you look at what's happening with globalization, with electronics, with the destruction of all the old institutions, not just colonialism, but all the post-World War II institutions, there is really a new world that's being created. And the question isn't whether it's going to be new or not. The question is whether in this era of electronics and computerized production, the 1% of society that controls society now is going to control it, or whether the masses of ordinary people are going to be able to control it and create a cooperative society. And I see a possibility where today what Thomas Paine talked about could come true. I mean, that there could be the birthday of a new world, a world without exploitation, a world without starvation, without hunger. But that's going to mean that the very bottom of society rises up and takes control of society. The society is organized around these new means of production, and we create a cooperative society. I think we have to stand on what was good in the past. We have to stand on the right of revolution stated in the American Declaration of Independence, but at the same time move forward, respecting what was accomplished then, recognizing that more needs to be accomplished now, and that we can have a society where no one has to starve to death today. I mean, food can be created in laboratories. No one has to be homeless. Housing can be created, prefabricated housing can be created in a matter of hours, and in certain places is, where it's only when it's profitable, but it can be done. People can be educated. People can have decent health care. The problem of it is we have a society where these things are not done unless it's profitable for this tiny 1% of society that controls all the wealth. But that's the thing that's got to change. We've got to be willing to challenge the status quo every bit as much as people challenged the status quo in 1776. 1776, for people to say monarchy is a bogus institution, was a very brave thing for people to do. For them to say colonialism is wrong was a brave thing. Well, we should be as intellectually brave as they were. And we should be able to say, contrary to all the stuff about, you know, that capitalist globalization is the end all and be all, it's the end of history, it's as far as we can go, it's the inevitable state of affairs and is human nature, that simply isn't true. If you look at books like, for instance, Origins by Richard Leakey, he talks about, in order for the human race itself to evolve out of apes, there had to be cooperation. I mean, that people had to communicate with one another, that the human race would not have survived without cooperation. And it seems to me that this concept that people are naturally greedy just it doesn't jibe with that there are people, there are some people who are greedy, you have a situation. I think what that's an example of is that the 1% of society assumes that everyone in society's morals are the same as its morals, and that isn't true. I mean, you see cooperation every day. Whenever there's a flood, whenever there's a crisis, whenever people have to pull together, people do pull together. In going back and reading about the American Revolution of the 1770s, one of the things that's most striking to me was how all the defenders of the old order claimed that aristocracy was human nature, that you had to have a king, that was human nature, you had to have nobles, that was human nature, that you could never, ever possibly have a society in which everyone was politically equal and you didn't have like a House of Lords and a House of Commons. And when the United States was set up at least nominally on the basis of political equality among those people who were allowed to vote, they said, well, the country will just fall apart. And in fact, in Europe, a lot of the European aristocrats at the time of the American Civil War claimed, well, see, this is the inevitable result of establishing a democratic republic, is that you end up with chaos because it's not human nature for there to be a democratic republic. Same thing was true of the advocates of slavery. The defenders of slavery absolutely swore up and down that it was human nature that somebody has to enslave somebody else, that you could never abolish slavery in the world, that there'd just be chaos and anarchy in the world, and the world would just fall apart if you abolished slavery. Well, we've abolished, you know, we abolished monarchy in the United States, and we've got problems in the United States, but it isn't because we abolished monarchy. We abolished slavery in the United States, and we have problems in the United States, but they aren't because we abolished slavery. So this sort of, every time I hear this human nature argument, you know, I have to remember that every old order claims that the status quo that benefits it is somehow the end-all and be-all of human nature. And it just isn't true. If we have the technological capacity now to feed every child on this planet, for us to allow any child to starve is wrong. And if the thing that stops that child from being fed is that we have a certain set of property relations, then we have to change those property relations. I mean, if it's possible for us to do something and we don't do it, then we have to answer morally why we didn't do it. I mean, one of the things that Thomas Paine did in Common Sense is he showed how that it was possible, it would be possible. In the end of the book, he has a rundown of certain economic facts, and he says, look, it'd be possible for these 13 colonies to be an independent country. It would work. You know, we have enough trees, we could cut them down, we could make ships, we could trade with these European countries. It's doable, is basically what he says at the end. He says, therefore, why, and it's pretty much inevitable. So he asks the question, are we going to do it, or are we going to just, you know, foist the issue onto our children so that they'll have to fight the battle? And what he says is that it's not honorable to foist it on our children or grandchildren. It should be on us. You know, that's a very famous sentence in another book. You know, if there must be blood, then let it be upon us and not upon our children. But if there's a fight that's got to go on, I think we have an obligation to fight it. And the battle is, why should any child starve when we have the technological capacity to feed every child? I read a statistic the other day where it said that to feed, clothe, and house every person without housing or food in the world would take only 4% of the income of the 225 richest people on Earth. Now, how can we allow those people to have their billions and all the people who go unfed and unhoused suffer the way they suffer? The word communism conjures up certain images, but the reality is that there have been communist revolutions throughout history. I mean, really, Spartacus in the time of the Roman Empire led a communist rebellion. It failed. Wat Tyler in England in the 1300s led a communist rebellion. It failed. There were not the material conditions for those rebellions to succeed at that time, at those times. But today, I think we do have the technological conditions for there to be a cooperative society. We should learn from the past. We should build on what was accomplished then. And as I said, move forward. I think the main thing to remember about the American Revolution is that it isn't finished yet.
This is People's Tribune Radio. And now our featured monthly commentary from Alan Harris, member of the editorial board of the People's Tribune, Tribuno del Pueblo.
A future without war. The time is in the not-too-distant future when the bad years humanity suffered through in the late 20th century is a fading memory. The scene is a 3D virtual audiovisual chat room on the Internet. It's a very popular place, especially among the young people. They can sit at terminals in homes, schools, libraries, town squares, and meet and become instant friends. Translation technology has long been perfected, so language is no problem. The older generations never cease to marvel at their children. The lives of these youth are much richer and happier than their parents could ever have imagined when they were their age. The young people won't have to spend their lives in dreary jobs, separated from their kids like their own parents had to. Now they can spend as much time as they need to raise children right and give them whatever they need to help them develop more fully as people with something to give to society. Naturally, there are bound to be new challenges for these young people to face, but gone forever are poverty, hunger, homelessness, suffering, ignorance, hatred, and war. The evils that crushed the spirit in the late 20th century vanished with capitalism. Back in the late 20th century, new technologies made it possible to build houses in 45 minutes, to communicate instantly with anyone in the world, to replace worn-out hearts with healthy new ones. The trouble was, a tiny class of capitalists held these tools and only enriched itself with them while everyone else starved in the streets. Wonderful tools, terrible times. While a few billionaires lived in arrogance and waste, the rest of the world's billions lived on a dollar a day. The capitalists used the technology to drive stock prices to new heights from where they dropped their laser-guided bombs on places like Iraq and Yugoslavia, killing defenseless people in their homes, on trains and buses, in markets, and even in hospitals. The young people of the post-capitalist future are aware of those horrible things. Understandably, they find them difficult to comprehend. The capitalists use the mass media to brainwash the youth with hate and self-destruction, to convince young people that because their labor was no longer needed by the employers, they were worthless and had no way out. The capitalists miseducated the youth, robbed them of their ability to think critically and discern right from wrong, good from bad. Eventually, the more isolated and confused young people believed the capitalists' lies and turned against themselves, their classmates and friends in tragic outbursts of violence. It got so bad that the youth killings at home and the wars overseas looked like one and the same thing. In a certain sense, they were. Homicide and suicide were the second and third leading causes of death for young people in America between ages 1 and 19. 2 million children died in wars around the world in the 1980s and 90s. In these wars, 90% of the fatalities were civilian and half of them were children. Half of the world's 60 million displaced people, homeless, refugees, and the like, were children. Millions of them were orphans. Because the new assault weapons were lighter and simpler than the heavier guns of past wars, children themselves became fighters. Child soldiers on the ground, high-tech soldiers in the air. There was the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child, which was drafted in 1989. 10 years later, all the countries of the world had signed it except two. One was Somalia, the other was the United States. Meanwhile, the capitalist system rotted like the corpse it was. And yet, out of death comes life. The seed was the vast majority of humanity overcoming the lies, hate, and despair of the old world and turning toward a vision of a new world. New messengers stepped forward to spread this vision that was more than a mere dream because the tools it was based on were very real. In the hands of the majority of humanity, we who had no stake in the capitalist system, we were able to use these tools to make real a world that gave life to all young people in the generation to come, a generation gathering in peace, in person or online, to build new bridges and not destroy them, to give each other life and not to take it away.
That's it for this month's edition of the program. People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. If you'd like more information about the League, its publications, or on how to order tapes of People's Tribune Radio, you can contact us at 1-800-691-6888. That's 1-800-691-6888. People's Tribune Radio is also available on the internet at www.ptradio.org. If your local radio station doesn't carry People's Tribune Radio, let them know that PTR is available free to community and micropower radio stations on cassette tape or via MPEG-3 format. My name's Mike Thornton. On behalf of Nicole Trejo, Sandy Reed, Chris Mann, Alan Harris, and the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, we invite you to join us next time for another edition of People's Tribune Radio.